Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
"Just another day in Baltimore," said the medical examiner, whose gray handlebar mustache dominated his gaunt face. "Shaw and the rest of those damn politicians have let our city become a playground for fallen women. Every slattern south of the New York has flocked here to make a dirty dollar." He shot a sharp look at the scribbling male attendant. "Don't put that in the notes." This is G.P. Gottlieb, host for New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, I'm talking to Bill Lefergy, author of Into the Suffering City, a novel of Baltimore. It's 1909, and Baltimore is a seedy town filled with corrupt politicians and small-minded racists who still complain about the War of Northern Aggression, known to the rest of the country as the Civil War. They're doing their best to keep blacks and immigrants at the least educated, least cared for state of being, and they're big fans of Jim Crow laws. For the most part, everyone is trying to survive however they can. And if they have to step on others to get out of the filth-filled streets, so be it. Into this mix comes a young female doctor who exhibits symptoms we now recognize as being on the autism scale. She's treated with disdain by fellow doctors and nearly everyone else except for a few family friends, and a struggling private detective who suffers from his own devastating mental condition. Then a showgirl is murdered. An innocent man is charged. And these two might just be the only ones who can save him. Hi, Bill. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Gleet. Thanks so much for having me here.
So you've enjoyed a long and illustrious career as a historian. So what inspired you now to write a murder mystery?
Well, I have to say that retirement actually helped a great deal. While I was working, I kept running across tidbits of real history that I thought, you know, that would really make for a good story. But that would mean I'd have to sit down and try and write it out. And working full time and dealing with my family and so on, I just never really figured I could get around to doing it. So I retired, and this was my initial retirement project, and I'm pretty pleased with the way it turned out.
Oh, it was just a wonderful mystery. How did you decide to set it in 1909, Baltimore?
It's really a fascinating time, and you know, when I started, I didn't sort of do a whole lot of research on historical mysteries. And I've since learned that Victorian England, World War I, and World War II are very, very popular sort of backdrops for a lot of historical mysteries. But I was drawn to 1909 because it's right in the middle of some very profound changes. Automobiles are replacing horses. Electricity is coming in and replacing gaslight. It's also really sort of this mounting wave of people coming in from the countryside off the farm to come into the city and make some money working in a factory or doing whatever, and just sort of exploring all the fun and excitement that could be had in the city that you would never be able to see on the farm. So it really just seemed to be a perfect time without the distraction of something like a world war or something like that going on, to try and capture the really sort of exciting spirit of change that was going on.
Yeah, you describe streets and buildings in the seafront of Baltimore. Baltimore is like a major character in your book. I read somewhere, or maybe on your website, that you lived there for about a decade. Why did that city get such a hold on you?
It was the first place where I lived after I graduated from college. And it was really the first place where I began my career. So it sort of imprinted itself on me. I began my career as a historian and archivist, and I eventually got to be the Baltimore City archivist and just had daily access to this incredibly rich documentary heritage about everything that went on in the city. Everything from very mundane things like street paving and street lighting to these very sort of major sort of social issues that the city faced from time to time. And as I mentioned, as I was sort of doing my daily work, I'd come across these tidbits and I'd think, you know, this would really be good in a novel. This would really be, you know, because it's just, you know, you have to struggle to make something like this up. So I just kept accumulating those sorts of things. And then eventually I moved away from Baltimore and started working in Washington, D.C. at the U.S. National Archives and then later at the Library of Congress and enjoyed that work tremendously. But Baltimore just had this kind of grip on my imagination from my earlier years there. And it just seemed like the perfect setting to try and write some sort of historical fiction with kind of a mystery twist.
Mm. As I mentioned in my introduction to this podcast, your protagonist would be considered today to be on the autism scale. At the end of the novel, you present a brief analysis of the history of autism, and like the good historian, you even included sources. So I read them and I loved the quote you included by Dr. Stephen Shore, who said, "If you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism." Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah. This is actually based on some personal experience. I have an adult son who is autistic, and he isn't exactly like Sarah, one of my protagonists, but there are some real similarities. And one of the things that I noticed, particularly when he was younger, is that when I would meet somebody and I would try to describe what was going on with them, inevitably someone would say, "Oh, it's like that movie with Dustin Hoffman, right? You know, he can do all these sort of numbers in his head," because odd as it is to believe right now in the world we live in today, back in the late 80s, early 90s, autism was really something that a lot of people didn't know much about. And that movie, Rain Man, sort of was the initiation or the sort of beginning of broader public awareness of what the condition was like. One of the problems with that is that a lot of autistic people tended to be lumped into a big category. You know, they, if only because I think most people have a lot of trouble really kind of conceptualizing what it's like for a person with autism. So, you know, I think it's human nature to kind of, you know, do some lumping and try and simplify something that's kind of complicated. But the trouble with that is that, you know, every individual is different. I'm different. You're different. But the same is true for an autistic person. They aren't all of a type. Quite different. They're quite different from each other. They have very distinct personalities, like any other individual. So as I was writing the book, I was very sensitive to trying to depict a person who could be seen as on the autism spectrum. And I tried to do it with a lot of sort of compassion and sympathy. But as I finished it, I thought, you know, I tried really hard, and I think I got this character right in a way that isn't going to upset most people. But, you know, just to be extra sure, I decided to put that note in the back that really kind of explains the broader context, particularly the history of autism, which, you know, it's just astounding how recent it is that that we have, even doctors have even a basic understanding of what this all about.
Yeah, we've come quite far. I remember my brother was dyslexic, and the teachers told my parents that he was mentally retarded.
Right.
And he graduated from the University of Chicago with a joint MBA JD. So take that, early educators. You also delve into schizophrenia because it would have been on the cutting edge of medicine in 1909. And your protagonists, since they don't know what's wrong with her, some of the doctors are sort of banding about the word schizophrenia. But when she assures them that she's not, the doctors easily respond that one sign of being schizophrenic is not realizing that you are. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Well, schizophrenia is another example of something that for many years was just misunderstood and sort of under a cloud. And even experts really had a lot of trouble grappling with what it was, and especially what to do with people who suffered from this. And as I was doing a bit of research for the book, I was fascinated to discover this sort of like nexus between schizophrenia and autism, which was, you know, this doctor in Switzerland. A remarkable guy who was really sort of the first one he invented the term schizophrenia. He's given credit with inventing the term autism, but he really sort of took the time to kind of understand people who were different, people in some cases who were suffering terribly, and sort of approached them in a very humane way. Which was not the standard way of dealing with mentally ill people, even well into the 20th century. Just you look back and standard treatments, and they're just awful. And of course, they were terribly, terribly bad in 1909 as well. So I thought it would be fascinating to kind of explore that connection between autism and schizophrenia, and kind of have this expert. One of the characters in the book is an expert psychologist, psychiatrist, who is up on all the more recent sort of theories. And one of those theories is schizophrenia, and some of the diagnostic criteria that they had for schizophrenia could be interpreted to apply to people with autism. So I enjoyed that quite a bit. I mean, it's a very serious subject and sad in a lot of ways, but still being able to kind of explore how the two sort of are related and how they're related, and then have this, you know, this expert apply this faulty diagnosis, but you know, at the time, it would have been very convincing for one of my main characters.
Mm-hmm. Your second protagonist, Jack, has what might now be diagnosed as PTSD. What can you tell us about him?
Yeah. And I wanted my other character, I have two protagonists, and the second protagonist is, I think it's fair to say, a fairly decent kind of guy, but I wanted to sort of give him some complexity. And as I was developing him, I'm thinking, well, what would, he comes from a very humble background with not much education or anything. And I was thinking, well, what would somebody like this do? And I sort of imagined them, all right, they would probably go into the army. He likes horses, so he goes into the cavalry. And right around this time, there was all this U.S. military intervention in the Philippines. And so I have this character, or part of his backstory is his experience in the Philippines during this Muslim uprising in the southern Philippines. And there actually was a historical event that he witnesses. And it was a horrific event. And it actually got a fair amount of press coverage at the time. It was pretty controversial. So I thought, suppose this guy was kind of a decent guy. And he sees this. And how is he going to react? And I'm thinking, he's also a tough guy. He isn't going to be shaking in his boots and crying himself to sleep. He's going to try and internalize it and try and deal with it the way a man is supposed to deal with things. But then, as now, there are consequences for that, for some individuals, for a lot of individuals. And of course, this is really hard because, he's a tough guy. He's not somebody given to a lot of introspection, but he's got all of these feelings and all this sort of repressed stuff that, manifests itself in some pretty unusual ways. And he has to try and cope with it. And it's really, really hard for him. And so he suffers a lot. But I also wanted to make it clear that you can suffer this way, but still maintain your humanity. He's still very much a guy with a moral center. And, his struggles are, I think, in a way, kind of make that even clearer, or at least that was my intent.
Mm-hmm. You call it the state of Maryland as being particularly racist. Were they more so than other states?
Well, I wouldn't say that they were the worst. they are below, and we still are, below the Mason-Dixon line. And Maryland, in many ways, still has some features of a southern state. It was known as a border state during the Civil War, which means it was occupied by the Union. But if the Union troops were in here, it probably would have joined the Confederacy. There was slavery all over the place, including in the city of Baltimore. And then after the Civil War, certainly Maryland was right up there in terms of some of the awful things that were done, the laws and lynching and some of the other terrible, terrible acts, tons of discrimination. Maryland, I think, certainly for a state that, while it isn't in the Deep South, Maryland did have a number of politicians who really worked pretty hard to sort of enforce a color barrier. To sort of separate the races, and I mentioned that a little bit in the in my sort of author's note in the back. And one of the key elements of that was this law, which I sort of knew about, but it was really interesting to research it. It's called miscegenation, which basically means if one person is white and the other person is black, you can't legally get married. And Maryland actually was the last or among the last states to sort of rub that out of their statutes in the late 60s. But not only was it declared that you couldn't, a black person couldn't marry a white person, the definition of a black person was pretty strict. If you had one great-grandparent who was African-American, you, as their descendant, were also considered African-American, no matter how you looked. You could look completely white, as white as they come, but under the law, you would be considered African-American. And Maryland actually has a long history of laws like that going all the way back to the colonial days. So again, I wouldn't say Maryland was the worst, but for a state with a major urban center like Baltimore, which was one of the major cities in the country, it was a very prosperous place. There was a lot of money in Maryland. It was it had a big industrial base. So it wasn't like the rural South. It was more like the North than the South in that way, but a kind of a very disturbing history of racism.
Shame on all of us for allowing it to go on. And thank heaven right now is when we're starting to see some changes, some serious changes. Speaking about political figures, they're all swaggering liars who are willing to do anything to hold on to power and who are quick to blame others for their transgressions. Just wondering, did you base them on anyone in particular?
I have a disclaimer in the front of the book that says this is an act of fiction, or a work of fiction. There were some characters at the time who sort of inspired some of the people I describe in the book. I wouldn't say anybody is an exact sort of portrayal. They're sort of composites, as they say. There actually was a very major machine politician in Baltimore at the time who sat in the lobby of the hotel that I mentioned in the book and conducted his business. Now, as far as I know, that person wasn't involved with some of the things this other character is involved with. But there's certainly Baltimore in its history of political shenanigans. There was plenty to draw on.
Mm-hmm. You also point out politicians who use the fear of immigrants and black people to solidify their bases. And I'm wondering if you were trying to show that there's nothing new under the sun.
Yeah. And that sort of developed as I was writing the book. And I was struck, well, first of all, I knew that the racism of the time in 1909 was horrible. But when I started going back and reading the daily newspapers and going through some of the publications and the stuff that was coming out of the state assembly at the time, I was really shocked just how blatant and how virulent the dislike or the hatred, really, I think you have to call it, of African Americans and immigrants. And part of it was political, because one political party sort of counted on African Americans and immigrants as part of their base, and another party wanted, very much like you hear today, wanted to sort of suppress that vote. So it's the same thing that that's going on today, very much so. Although the difference, I think, is that today, for the most part, not always, but for the most part, there really is a lot of people are sensitized, and it's not considered cool for a politician to be too overtly racist. In 1909, that was not the case. The more you could sort of lay it on, the more your voters liked it. And even if you counted some of these populations as your base, you didn't want to be too friendly with them because you were also counting on whites as part of your base as well. So it was a pretty nasty sort of political climate. And dare I say, even nastier than today's, which is saying.
The newspapers of the day don't get a lot of admiration from you regarding the way they supported racist behavior, et cetera. Do you see any progress in the past century or so with newspapers?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. You know, there's, you know, I mentioned sensitivity before, and I think you see that very much so these days. I noticed that, for example, the New York Times just a couple of days ago decided they were going to capitalize black in news stories. You know, it used to be a lowercase b, and now they're making it an uppercase b. So I think newspapers in particular and other sorts of media outlets sort of feel an obligation to be aware of things that have gone on in the past and try to do a better job. But as I mentioned before, in relation to politics, there just was nothing like that 100 years ago in 1909. You know, you were considered pretty radical if you came out and said, you know, black people are the equal of white people. You would really be out there in terms of making a statement like that. And most people, most white people, certainly were of the opinion that, you know, racism is a fact of life. That's just the way things have always been. And that's the way things are always are going to be. And, you know, that's a good thing.
Interestingly, your autistic character is colorblind.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, she doesn't, you know, she doesn't pick up on social cues very well. It's a hallmark of an autistic personality. And sort of distinctions among people, class distinctions and educational distinctions and racial distinctions, just aren't things that sort of mean as much. I mean, she doesn't really sort of read the signal of what that might mean. And, you know, that kind of, you know, inability to kind of understand what's going on socially has advantages and disadvantages. She is colorblind. She's not very judgmental about people, with some exceptions. But and certainly in terms of class or race, she's not judgmental about that at all. But on the other hand, she also really struggles socially, because she can't really interact in a way that people regard as normal. She's regarded as strange and odd and kind of mechanical, and perhaps not even human, which is something that you sort of see running throughout a lot of even fairly recent sort of portrayals of autistic people. And one of the struggles I had in writing the book and doing this character is I wanted her to come across as quirky, but I didn't want her to come across as a parody. She's a real individual. I wanted her to be a real individual. And, but also somebody who, if you met them, you would really be struck by, you know, this is not a typical kind of person. This is somebody who's pretty unusual.
Mm-hmm. Men don't come off that well in the novel. They're small-minded or they're slobs or they have serious problems. What's up with that?
Men during this era had a lot of freedom. I mean, they kind of ruled the roost. Women couldn't vote. They were very much second-class citizens. Men sort of were 99% of the professions, lawyers, doctors, what have you, professors. They ran businesses. They controlled the money. So if they wanted to act like a slob or a pig, they could get away with it. And again, sort of like racism, there really wasn't a whole lot of sensitivity about treating women with dignity and respect, quite the opposite. I mean, there was a lot of misogyny, simply because, again, these were people who could get away with it. And it was just regarded as, you know, that's just the way you behave. And that's fine.
Mm-hmm. What did you uncover in your research about the Pinkerton agency? They have a role in this mystery.
Yes, the Pinkertons are a fascinating group. They were sort of the FBI before the FBI, in a way. They were the largest sort of law enforcement, well, not really law enforcement, but just kind of quasi-law enforcement organization in the country at this time. There were really a lot of urban police departments were still sort of trying to scale up and still trying to deal with these incredibly growing populations. There really wasn't much in the way of a national kind of police force. And there was a belief among a lot of people that if you had a problem, you didn't really want to call the police. They might not come, they might not do a terribly good job. They might not do what you wanted them to. But if you called a place like the Pinkertons, you could get somebody or a couple of somebodies who would be very responsive to your needs, particularly if you had a lot of money. And the Pinkertons in particular really developed a reputation for ruthlessness. They were involved in the Homestead Strike in the 1890s in Pittsburgh, where there's a bunch of steel workers who went on strike. The steel owners, Carnegie and people who worked with him, brought in a whole bunch of Pinkertons to break the strike. And lots of people got killed. And the Pinkertons' reputation for sort of brutality and some, you know, operating outside the law really kind of got a boost from that. So I knew something about the Pinkertons, and I knew they had a bureau in Baltimore. So I thought, yeah, this might be an interesting thing to kind of work into the story.
Hmm. So Bill, just between you and me, I won't tell anyone. Do Jack and Sarah end up together? Well, is there going to be another book? What are you working on?
Yes, there is a sequel that I am working on madly. And I will not reveal what goes on, what the final outcome of their relationship it is. But they're drawn to each other. They sort of complement each other and in a pretty interesting way. Now, in terms of, you know, what the future might hold, obviously there's some barriers. if something like that were to happen, it's going to be interesting to explore, not only in a sequel, but perhaps in books beyond that.
Ah, so we can look forward to another one maybe next year?
Yeah, my hope is to have it out by early next year.
I'm expecting a call.
All right, we will.
Thanks so much for joining me today, Bill. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for joining me. Again, this is G.P. Gottlieb, author of the Whipped and Sipped Mystery Series and host for New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, I've been talking with Bill Lafferge, author of Into the Suffering City, a novel of Baltimore. If you enjoyed today's podcast and would like to discuss it further with me and other New Books Network listeners, please join us on Shuffle. Shuffle's an ad-free, invite-only network focused on the creativity community. As NBN listeners, you can get special access to conversations with a dynamic community of writers and literary enthusiasts. Sign up by going to www.shuffle.do/NBN/join.